everybody, and welcome to Adjusted. I'm your host, Greg Hamlin, coming at you from beautiful Birmingham, Alabama, and Berkeley Industrial Comp. And I wanted to introduce today our rebroadcast. This is actually one of my favorite episodes, going all the way back to first season with my good friend Ryan McIntosh. And Ryan actually heads up our subrogation unit. And I think subrogation is one of those confusing topics, especially for adjusters, because most of the time in workers' compensation, we focus on claims investigation, reserving, all of those things. And we sometimes can forget about subrogation. And Ryan does such a nice job of talking through the important things to keep in mind so that you can have successful subrogation on your workers' compensation claim. Also, this is fun because this is one of the earlier episodes that I did, when we were just figuring out who we were as a podcast. And here we are years later, or more than 3 years later, still continuing to podcast. So enjoy this episode, and I'll let you listen from here with Ryan, Claire, and myself. Thanks, guys.
Episode 6 of Adjusted, the podcast for claims professional enthusiasts. I am your host, Claire Musselman, coming to you from Des Moines, Iowa, and representing the Continental Western Group with my co-host,
Greg Hamlin, coming at you from Berkeley Industrial Comp and Sweet Home, Alabama.
Today, we have a very special guest from WR Berkeley Corporation. We are graced with the presence of Mr. Ryan McIntosh. Ryan is the National Recovery Director of Berkeley Subrogation Services. Ryan, welcome to Adjusted.
Well, thank you, Claire and Greg. It's great to be here.
All right, Ryan. So inquiring minds want or need to know, how on earth did you get into subrogation?
Well, I actually come from a long line of subrogation professionals. said no one ever, right? I got into insurance, like a lot of people, really just kind of out of necessity. Right after school, I needed a job, right? So I applied at, it's actually Allied Insurance at the time here in Des Moines, Iowa. And that was really the beginning of it. Kind of worked my way through a call center and then into claims, and eventually found my home in subrogation, and have been doing subrogation exclusively for going on 15 years now.
So what makes you stay? Like, if you've been doing this, it's kind of become your niche. You're very well known. I know you've served on the board of directors for NASP, and there's a couple other entities that have sought you out because you are pretty passionate about subro. What keeps you in it? What is it about subrogation that sets your soul on fire?
Well, let me tell you a story. So prior life, working for a carrier, and we insured a nonprofit that worked in the space of feeding the people in their community that needed meals, wouldn't otherwise be able to have meals. And they insured a building. And one day, through no fault of their own, this truck comes careening around a corner and smashes into their building and causes, you know, upwards of about $100,000 in damage. So we, the insurance carrier, pay the cost to repair that vehicle minus their $10,000 deductible. And through this process of subrogation, we were able to pursue a subrogation claim for the $100,000 against the driver of that vehicle and his insurance carrier. And we were able to collect that $100,000 back. And what we do is, once we get that $100,000, we write a reimbursement check back to that policyholder. So in this case, it was $10,000. And the director of that nonprofit called, and she was almost in tears, thanking me for this check. And I said, well, you know, it's really just part of what I do. And insurance is really why your insurance companies pursue subrogation claims. And she said, do you know what that $10,000 means to us as a small nonprofit with not a lot of means? And I said, well, no, not exactly. She said, well, it costs about $2 a meal to feed the people in our community. So this $10,000 means that's 5,000 meals that we get to provide to someone that wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity to have dinner, right? And that just stuck with me. And that was maybe 10 years ago. And I think about that almost weekly, right? So that's why that's why I'm passionate about the work we do. You know, not every claim is going to have some kind of sentimental story to it, but there are those out there that that exists, and it does make a difference. The work that we do really does make a difference, not only to our policyholders, but to the communities at large that they serve.
I love that. That is so awesome. Thank you for sharing that. So I'm going to transition a little bit. So being the National Recovery Director for Berkeley Subrogation Services, you have taken a unique approach to kind of how the Berkeley families work together. Do you want to, can you talk to us a little bit about how you have brought in these collaboration efforts? Because I know that you provide services not only for Continental Western Group, but you also get to grace Greg's presence with Berkeley Industrial Comp as well. So can you talk about kind of how that came about and how you have gone to collaborate with the other operating units and really kind of make this a unique niche?
Yeah. So in 2017, I was asked to come join the team at Berkeley with the idea of creating a centrally managed subrogation/recovery department. The idea being that all boats would be lifted by one dedicated unit of subrogation professionals trained and tasked exclusively with pursuing subrogation claims. So at the time we started, there were six operating units that had agreed to work with us. And, you know, one of the challenges in getting any group of people together or any group of companies together is figuring out collaboration and communication and consistency and all of those words, right? So that, I think that was the biggest real challenge, was just getting each of those six operating units on board. And the way that we were able to do that was going out and meeting them and understanding what their specific needs are, right? And, you know, I say getting out and traveling, that seems like a foreign concept right now, right? Because of COVID. But spending a lot of time with each of those operations and their claim leaders, understanding specifically what their needs are and how we can help them achieve their goals. And what we were able to do after spending about 6 months of dedicated time just learning and understanding the business is figuring out what a process could look like that would be repeatable for the folks on our team, right? Because what I can't do is I can't create six different processes, because it will lose any potential gains and efficiency that we might otherwise have. So what we're able to do is put together an innovative process that uses technology, collaboration, and allows us to provide subrogation services now to, I think we're up to 19 operating units, believe it or not, which is amazing. So we've got one process that works relatively well for all of the 19, and I shouldn't even say relatively well, works very well for the 19 that we're providing services to. So it's been a lot of fun.
Good work on that. All right, so let's go back to, can you explain subrogation for those who might not have any idea what it is that we're actually talking about? Let's talk about all the other stuff, but really, we're here to have you talk to us about subrogation and what it is. You did a nice job of illustrating that, I think, with your example for why you're passionate about this topic. So for those who are listening that are not familiar with subrogation, I think that was a really good illusion, but can you give more specifics surrounding that?
Yeah, so basically, at its core, subrogation is the process by which insurance companies reclaim the money paid out for insurance claims, right? And so this process typically involves three parties: the insured, the policyholder, and the bad guy, right? And so the process of subrogation is the process of the insurance company and the policyholder getting together and going after that bad guy and holding him or her financially responsible for the damage they caused to our policyholders, right? So we talked about in the example earlier, it was a car crash, right? A car ran into a building. You know, our insured didn't do anything wrong to cause that damage. The insurance company stepped in, made sure we took care of our policyholder, and then went after the bad guy's insurance company, right? So there's a subrogation process for property claims for auto, so two cars involved in an accident, but also workers' compensation, the space you folks work in, right? So every day, injured workers are sustained injuries on the job due to the result of someone else's negligence. And the process of subrogation allows us, the employer, or the employer's carrier, to go after and pursue those parties responsible.
So Ryan, our adjusters are so busy focusing on trying to get injured workers back to work and to make sure they have great outcomes. What are some of the things that they should be looking for from a subrogation standpoint that would highlight, you know what, this is a claim that we probably need to take a look at because there might be a liability issue here?
So I think one of the things that I'd recommend, if you two are in good hands, for those listening, if you don't have a process that lends itself to this, I recommend looking into it anyway. And Greg, you're exactly right. Your adjusters, your examiners are focused on making sure that injured worker is getting taken care of, right? Getting to their appointments, getting those invoices paid, and doing all the things they need to get that worker back on their feet. Early on in the process or the life cycle of any claim, I think it is helpful if your examiners have a dedicated team of subrogation professionals that they can involve early on in the life cycle of that claim to help with that early investigation, because our focus is solely on identifying responsible parties, right? So one of the things I think they need to do is have a resource that they can rely on early on in the life cycle of that claim to ask questions, right? Now, not everybody has that. So if that's not an option, some of the things they need to just think about, and I've got a mantra that I've said, you know, probably 1,000 times by this time in my career, right? Think subro early, think subro often, and think subro on every claim. Right. So if you can do those things, think, you know, why did this happen? And is there any potential that this injury was the result of someone else's negligence? We need to think about subrogation and getting the right folks involved at that time.
That's great. I know, you know, just back when I was an adjuster, it wasn't that long ago, I can remember getting caught up in all of the pieces and parts of getting somebody back to work and then missing that. And I remember my supervisor pointing that out. Oh, there's subro on this one. We need to get them involved. So I know when you get referrals, there are certain things that need to be preserved, or it's helpful if they're preserved so that they can further the cause of subrogation. And one of the reasons maybe why you want to get that to somebody early to take a look at, can you talk about some of those things?
Yeah. So I think for the purpose of this, we'll think about third-party liability and workers' compensation arising from maybe three different scenarios, right? We'll look at use of a vehicle, use of a product, and use of a premises, right? And what you're going to need in terms of evidence, I think, varies based on what scenario we're looking at. So use of a vehicle, for example, right? A real common example, and probably the one that first comes to mind for everybody, is a police report, right? Get that police report, because that's going to give us at least some documentation about what happened in the accident. So I will tell you that police reports are important, right? But that's not the only piece of information we need, because with very rare exception, police officers do not actually witness accidents, right? So they're relying on someone else's testimony to put on paper what they think happened. And 99% of the time, they do a really good job. But there's that 1% of the time where things are just completely wrong or off the rails, right? So police reports are important. Scene photographs are important, right? So, and scene photographs immediately following the accident, right? Because lost scenes can change. So take, for example, an accident that occurs in a construction zone, right? So an accident that happens today, the scene is going to look very different than it's going to look in 6 months once the scene is, once the construction's complete and you got the normal flow of traffic. So that's another reason why it's important to get subrogation folks involved early, so we can help document the scene, whether it be an accident or a slip and fall or motor vehicle accident or whatever. We can help document early on exactly what that scene looked like at the time of accident, because that can be crucial in our ability to pursue a subrogation claim. So police report, scene photographs, and more commercial automobiles have dash cam footage, right? So ask the question, is there dash cam footage available? And I can tell you what, dash cam video footage is changing the landscape in the world of commercial auto subrogation, because it takes the guesswork out of figuring out what the heck happened. Because now what we have is actual footage of what happened. So I can tell you what color that light was. I can tell you that they made a turn on a solid red and not a green arrow, right? So it takes the guesswork out of it. So dash cam footage is helpful. Witness information, and then to the degree possible, any event data recorder information that's available in that vehicle. So an EDR or black box, think about it. You always hear in airplane crashes, the black box, this mysterious black box that's got all of the answers in it. Cars have a smaller version of that in them. If we're involved in the process and in the investigation early on in the life cycle of that claim and that vehicle is equipped with an EDR, we have experts that can go out and download data that'll give us things that'll give us an indication of what that vehicle was doing immediately prior to impact. So that's use of a vehicle, use of a product. So let's talk about an injured worker that is injured as a result of the failure of a product. So obviously, if we can have the product itself, that's the most important thing that we can have. And not only the product itself, but the product itself in an unaltered state from when it was when it caused the injury, right? So we don't want the injured worker, we don't want the policyholder to continue to use this product that injured someone for 3 or 4 months until we can get out and inspect it, or even 3 or 4 days until we can get out and inspect it. So to the degree possible, keep the product itself in its unaltered state so that we have a chance to inspect it and determine exactly what about that product caused the injury. Copies of any purchase documentation. And the reason that's important is because in a products claim, we not only will pursue a products claim against the manufacturer of that product, but also the party that they brought it from, suppliers, distributors, and manufacturers are all potential defendants in any products liability cases that we would bring. Maintenance records, any operating or training manuals, safety logs, safety inspection reports, OSHA reports. OSHA reports can be valuable to us. And then more and more frequently, particularly with our larger insureds, we're seeing that the policyholders will actually do an accident investigation of their own. So to the degree possible that those reports are available, they are incredibly helpful. We're talking about use of a premises. Certificates of insurance for all of the contractors on site are important, just so we know who all of the players are in this particular case. Any applicable indemnification or hold harmless agreements, because those may or may not have an ability, have an impact on our ability to pursue a subrogation claim. And then again, scene photos, surveillance footage, and we're talking about damage or dash cam footage now. Just about every building has some sort of surveillance footage available. When it comes to surveillance footage, one of the things I just remind people is that time is of the essence when we're looking for surveillance footage, because a lot of those systems are designed to record over themselves in a short amount of time, 2-3 days. So it's important that we're asking the questions, are there any cameras that might have caught this injury on, and if so, do we have the ability to download the data? And again, getting out there on scene early on is incredibly crucial. So it's a very long-winded answer to a pretty short question. I'm sorry, Greg, but like everything we do, it so much depends on the claim.
I love
you
that.
Know, Ryan, that's why we love you. We need to have somebody who can get that excited about all the that are money back.
Absolutely. So Ryan, we are entering that lovely winter time period, which I would joke about because it's been like 65 here in Des Moines. So sorry, Greg. But what about weather when we're looking at subro? So when we talk about like accidents, and I know we talk about taking accident photos, what about weather related? Like, is there things that we need to be aware of when we are investigating from that aspect as well?
Yeah. So this is the time for slips and falls, right? So we talked about scene photos and scenes changing. Claire, I can tell you that it's 65 today, but it's going to snow and be 25 probably in about 48 hours. So
That's
it's terrifying.
God, love the Midwest.
God, I love the Midwest.
Come back. Indiana misses you. Indiana wants to come home.
I'll stay in the South where it's nice and warm.
In all seriousness.
You know, but right, people slip and fall on snow and ice and all the time. And the tricky thing about snow and ice is that it's always changing, evaporating, melting, going away, or freezing, refreezing. So anytime you're dealing with a loss caused by weather, documenting the scene via statements, weather reports, photos actually, as close as possible to the time immediately following the accident or injury is incredibly important, because this scene can change so much. So something else to keep in mind is that, you know, as we're looking at these slips and falls, it's important to understand if there were any third parties responsible for snow and ice removal, right? So if our policyholder is responsible for snow and ice on their own property and someone slips and falls, that makes it a little challenging. We're not going to pursue our own policyholder for these injuries. But if they have a contract with, you know, Joe's Snow Removal Service, and in that contract it says that they will come out every time there's more than 2 inches of accumulation of snow or ice, and we're able to determine that, you know, they hadn't done that, and it snowed 6 inches 2 days ago, and they hadn't been out, and our injured worker slipped and fell in the snow, then maybe potentially we have a claim. So documenting the scene, understanding if there's any responsibility for snow and ice removal are probably two of the biggest things that that we look at in weather losses.
Awesome. Then I've got one more question, since I'm going to try and relate this a little bit, since we've been in a pandemic and COVID and whatnot. So when we are, whether it be our insureds or maybe looking at it like from a third party stance. What about chemicals? Like, do chemicals ever come in play for Subro? Like, if it's a cleaning company or any, I don't know, anything around those lines. I'm just trying to tie this into the pandemic time period as well. And while we tread lightly in workers' compensation around this topic, I think it's one that definitely probably should be addressed.
Yeah. So, chemicals, the good thing about chemicals is they are more often than not, there's heavy federal regulation and guideline about how they are labeled, stored, manufactured, and that sort of thing, right? So if we have an injured worker that has exposure to a chemical and suffers an injury as the result, what we will try to do is work backwards and first identify the chemical to make sure that whomever was responsible for presenting that chemical into the environment where the injured worker was injured has done everything in accordance with guidelines, right? OSHA is our friend here, right? So OSHA has strict guidelines on how many toxic chemicals are applied, stored, et cetera, like I said. So chemicals can present unique challenges. I don't know where I'm going with that.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, if we've got injured workers that happen to, like, I know that we've seen it in the past where, say, that they ate a janitorial company or it's any type of, maybe it's a school janitor or whatnot, and they have been exposed to some type of chemical and they pass out from the fumes.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're trying to figure out, oh my gosh, what were the chemicals? What do they look like? And I know that there's, like, we've got to get the product information and we have to see exactly what you had said, where it's stored and all of that information, and look at the OSHA regulations that surround all of this and have that fun topic, because I know a lot of this stuff depends. So I was just curious on, like, what needs to be obtained and kept in that kind of a scenario.
Well, I think you just did a great job of explaining that, probably a better job than I can do, right?
Just missing my Subro days back in the day.
Yes. Yes. Claire has a background in subrogation, which is
helpful. It was the gators. I just really wanted a Subro gator. Little alligators. Little squishy alligators.
Did we send you any Subro gators when I came down there, Greg?
No, I have never gotten one. So.
Oh, no. We've got a whole box of them. We'll have to figure out how to get them down. They're COVID-free alligators.
and they won't bite you. It's okay.
they're little stress balls, but they're shaped like alligators and subrogator, right? And it's just something to keep in front of the adjuster so that they're always thinking subrogation.
That is fantastic. I love that. Yeah. So, Ryan, when you're thinking about all the different jurisdictions across the United States, I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges of subrogation is there's not a one-size-fits-all. There's a 50 different variants. So when you're thinking about some of the challenges that you face jurisdictionally, what are some of those? And what are things that we could be doing to help as an adjuster to make sure we're setting things up well?
Yeah. Okay. So you're right. And like we said earlier, so, everything is contingent on location. And so it's incredibly important. So I think a good place to start, one of the more obvious, is each state has a different comparative or contributory negligence statute. And the reason that that's important is that comparative or contributory negligence statute will determine our ability to pursue a subrogation claim based on any negligent actions of our policyholders, right? So there are jurisdictions where our policyholder could be up to 50% at fault, and we would still would have the ability to pursue a subrogation claim against responsible parties. And there are other places, like in Alabama, where if we contribute to an accident in any way, we are barred completely from pursuing a subrogation claim. So location does matter. another example, or another way that venue matters, is the state statute of limitations, right? So that statute of limitation dictates how long we have to bring a claim against any potential tortfeasors. We talked about product liability. A state's product liability laws may limit or cap the amount of damages we can pursue as a result of a subrogation claim. There are things like made whole statutes, which governs, you know, in the event of a subrogation recovery, who gets the money first? Is it the insurance company? Is it the policyholder? Is it the injured worker? Right. And kind of along those same lines, you know, in the event, and we got a large comp case and we are pursuing a claim in tandem with the injured worker, in the event of a large settlement beyond whatever our workers' compensation lien might be, each state's statute or law governs how future credits or holidays are applied. So that's kind of outside the world of subrogation, but it comes back to one of those benefits that we can provide to an insurance partner, and that not only are we getting that lien back, we're also helping protect you against further liabilities through those future credits. So each state's rules on how those credits are applied varies.
All right. So you're talking about the injured, you guys are pursuing a third party action with the injured worker. So this makes me think about if I'm an insured and we have something happen, like let's say a tire blows up. If I'm an insured, what do I need to protect for you to be successful in being able to pursue a third party action? And how quickly do we need to act on that? Like what, if I'm an insured, what do I do? All right. So I've just had an accident and I know I need to preserve something from an evidence standpoint, but what do I do with this stuff?
Everything. Protect everything, right?
Think about it. Can I just take it to Greg's house and go store it in Greg's garage?
Right. Sure. No. That's
Touch it, Greg. Chain of command.
Right. One of the challenges in the work that I do is that if every accident occurred in a vacuum and nothing changed, it would make my job incredibly easy, right? But that's not the case. We understand that. Bad things happen to people, they get hurt, and then life kind of needs to go on for that operation in some degree. It sounds cold, but it needs to happen, right? Just so that business can get up and running, continue to exist. So in the example of your tire case, certainly keep the tire, right? That's important because we knew that it failed. But let's think about why it failed. What was going on? What was that injured worker doing prior to that tire failing, right? Maybe he's inflating it. Right. So in order to inflate it, it was probably being mounted on some sort of press. Right. So we need to make sure that the press stays in the same condition it was. Maybe there was something about that press that caused this tire to be damaged and then to explode. But let's continue to work backwards. Right. Where's the air coming from to inflate this tire? Right. So now we've got the hose and then ultimately an air compressor. Right. Where was this air compressor plugged in? Right. So, I mean, you can kind of work your way backwards and really just think beyond the obvious. And it's another reason why getting someone trained and specialized in the type of work early on is incredibly important, because while your adjuster, your examiner may say, oh, it's the tire. Let me make sure the tire, Mr. Insured, don't let that tire disappear. But then they continue to use the air compressor, the tire mount, and no one's taking it where it was plugged in. You know, those are all things that can contribute to a potential subrogation claim. So,
Why is chain of command important in that scenario?
Right. So let's just take the example we're talking about, right? So we've got a tire potential manufacturer, a distributor. We've got the manufacturer of the press. We've got a manufacturer of the air compressor. We've got a manufacturer of the air supply line. We have suppliers for all of those things. And all of those people are going to be potential defendants in any litigation that we might bring. And so if we're not very careful in documenting where all of these different pieces of evidence are at all times and the chain of custody as they're going from one place to another for inspection, each of those defendants is going to argue what is called spoliation, right? So yeah, they're going to argue that, you know what, you can't bring your claim against us because you didn't give us a fair opportunity to inspect these components in the condition they were immediately following the accident. We want out, right? And our role here in subrogation is to keep those people in the game as long as possible so that we have more pockets to take money from, right? So that's the name of the game here, right? Increase the number of potential defendants, collect more money. So chain of custody is a way for those defendants to get out of potentially staying involved, and we would really like to do the opposite.
So Ryan, I know when we have a big claim where there's a fatality involved, or and we know, you know, we had a difficult claim not long ago where an injured worker was working alongside the road and was hit by a vehicle. And ended in a fatality, which is really sad. But those claims really stand out. When we see those claims, we think, oh, there could be subrogation here. We need to make sure we get it there. What about the small claims? And, you know, a lot of times, a lot of the claims we handle are small and may have subrogation potential. Is it worth it to send those over?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So every dollar, whether it be associated with a large claim or a small claim, goes right back to the insurance carrier's bottom line, right? And that has benefits to the policyholder in that they're getting their deductibles back, like we talked about earlier. They've got lower loss experience. They got better experience mods. And then ultimately, they're going to pay less in premiums. So whether the claim is large or small, it's important that we pursue every subrogation claim to the best of our ability. Now, the large claims get a lot of attention, right? Because, well, they're large and they're catastrophic and often tragic. I think where a really successful subrogation operation differentiates themselves is in their ability to identify and pursue those smaller claims that otherwise don't get the attention that the bigger ones do, right? Because while the smaller ones are small individually, combined, they have a bigger impact on your ultimate loss experience than those bigger ones do, right? So the better job we can do on the kind of day-to-day type claims, recognizing that they have potential, making the right decisions about how to pursue them or not pursue them, right? That's also something that we opt to do at times. It's those smaller ones, I think, that really at the end of the day will have the biggest impact on your results.
Just to maybe take that a step further, that would be maybe one common mistake an adjuster might make is to avoid those or forget about them because they're small. And we've talked about some other things that can go wrong. That what are some other common mistakes that you have seen in your career adjusters make that make your job a little more difficult?
So I see this note far too often, and it drives me just as mad today as it did the first time I saw it. And it says that this loss was caused by an accident. The other party didn't intend for it to happen, right? Well, they're called accidents for a reason, right? But just because you didn't do something on purpose doesn't mean that you're any less responsible financially for the damage that you caused, right? So I think that's probably the one that sticks out the most. But the other thing that makes our job difficult is difficult, not impossible. Difficult is waiting until the claim is fully developed to get us involved, right? Maybe making assumptions that, you know, this is a pretty straightforward accident. I don't need to have subrogation involved. Let me go ahead and get this paid, and then I'll send it to them at the end of a claim, right? So on the surface, accidents, let's say a car accident, for example, where an injured worker is injured in a car accident, it may appear that, you know, the other party made a left turn and smashed into our insured, right? You take our insured's word for it. Sure, that's what happened, until we start asking questions of the other driver, and they've got a completely different version of the story, right? So I guess maybe overestimating the simplicity about what a subrogation action might be is another thing that can cause us problems. You talked about securing evidence, and not doing that or not getting us involved can certainly make life difficult for us as well.
Okay, so I like what you're talking about with this. So when we're explaining this to an insured, for example, and they say, well, I really don't want you going after a customer of mine or a client of mine, how do you navigate that? Or if you're an adjuster, how do you have that conversation when we're actually talking about insurance policies? And does it matter when we're talking about a dollar figure? Or, I don't know, can you give some insight into your thoughts behind that from a subrogation standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely. So, when that happens, what I find myself doing is just having a conversation about the insured and helping them kind of understand where we're at and how pursuing a subrogation claim will improve their life. Right? Like, I understand you don't want us to pursue a subrogation claim against Joe's Plumbing because you grew up with Joe and he does all of your business and he's your best buddy in the world and you don't want to create any bad blood in the relationship. I understand. However, if we do not pursue the subrogation claim against Joe's insurance carrier, you are going to be out your deductible. You're going to have a very large claim on your loss experience. You're going to pay more for insurance coverage for your business for the rest of the existence of your business, right? And so they start thinking, wait a minute, maybe it's more than just this one claim. And so the other thing that we do is we spend a lot of time working with the insurance carrier and the policyholder, making them understand that what we are recommending is that we pursue that cherished business partner up to any available liability limits they may have. And maybe what we'll agree to do is waive any damages that are beyond that. But let's at least consider pursuing the available insurance coverage they have. That's why they have it. Let's make a claim. So it's really just education and communication and collaboration, getting everybody on board and helping them understand, you know, why the work we're doing is important and how it will, in the end, benefit the policyholder.
I think education and making the information consumable is something that we can all continue to work on when looking at this from a subrogation standpoint. All right, so I have one final question for you. What is one of the most interesting claims that you have seen while in subrogation?
All right, so interesting in the aspect that I think that this claim was a success because of the relationship and process we had built with the carrier. We had insured a company that was in the business of distributing baked goods. And one morning, we were making a delivery to an establishment early in the morning. And in the process of making that delivery to one of our customers, some bad guys come in armed. And unfortunately, shoot a couple of people on in the store, including our injured worker. Thankfully, he survived, had some pretty catastrophic injuries, but lived to tell the story. Claim gets reported to the workers' compensation carrier. The adjuster says this is going to be a big claim. We know that someone else is responsible for this, the bad guy. Problem is, we don't know who the bad guy is, but let me get this over to subrogation. And so we start looking at it, and obviously obvious targets, who? The bad guy, right? The shooter, right? But do bad guys typically have a lot of money?
No.
No, they don't, right?
The restitution for $7 for the end of time.
Right. So bad guys don't have a lot of money, so they make bad subrogation targets, right? So we start asking questions and looking at place, the location where he was when he was shot. So our insured customer. And what we were able to do through discovery and ongoing litigation is determine that this policy, this location where we were making this delivery, had been robbed on several occasions prior. It was in a terrible part of town, and they had very strict protocols that they were to follow when allowing delivery persons on site before business hours. We were able to determine that they failed to follow their own protocol and created a hazardous environment and essentially contributed to our injured worker suffering very serious injuries. So through litigation, we're able to make sure that this guy gets enough money to kind of go on for the rest of his life, bring some money back into the insurance carrier, and ultimately it was a good story. But the reason that I think that is good is because there was a subrogation recovery on a file that, in the end, yes, we knew someone was responsible, but it was really looking beyond the obvious, right? So looking beyond the bad guy with a gun. And I think that's maybe why this is the most interesting case I can think of, because without that adjuster just doing the obvious and getting it over to us, this claim doesn't happen, right? That could have easily just ended up in a closed stack of claims and nobody would have ever been any the wiser, right?
Yeah, you've said that a couple of times now. Like, we've got to look beyond the obvious. And I think, you know, as we continue down in the claims world in general, you know, we do see artificial intelligence coming through a little bit more so. But this is where it is looking outside the box and really trying to seek from that artistic standpoint of, all right, what really is this entire picture? What does it look like? And how do we effectively navigate the system and the space to make sure that you're getting things timely so you guys can do your solid investigation and we can be collaborative partners for the success for our injured workers and for our insured. So I really appreciate that example.
Yeah, excellent. It's a great example.
Well, Ryan, any final thoughts for anyone listening today?
Think subro early, think subro often, think subro on every claim, right? You can do those three things, you'll be in good shape.
Awesome. I'd like to thank you for your time and for making this happen with us today. Join us next time where we will be discussing the wonderful world of return to work and the different options that are available if an insured is unable to return someone to work within their own four walls. Have a great day. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
See you next time. We want to thank Cameron Runyon for his excellent intro music. If you are interested in adding some music to your life, please feel free to contact him. We will provide his information in our show notes.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you join us for future episodes releasing every 2 weeks on Monday. Thanks again, and happy listening.